Elon Musk is not funny. He's like a kind of second year boarding school boy trying to be naughty.
Naughty boy.
I'm not naughty.
He admitted he was a troll.
Nazi salute on the world stage. Ill-advised. Quite easy to get a pose of virtually anybody doing a Nazi salute if you just go through enough video.
It is.
If you pick the right moment. But you say that's like kind of happened twice during the live event.
And also he had his left hand clenched on his heart as well.
Was he stamping his heels together and shouting, I'm Führer!
Not yet. Maybe after a couple of weeks when the power gets to his head.
If you're a jokey kind of person with dangerous weapon in your hand, got your hand on the button, and people can't take you seriously or anything you say.
A joker.
In the 80s, Ronald Reagan did it. Reagan said, oh, we begin bombing in 5 minutes. And everyone was like, whoa, that's not funny. That's
funny. My fellow Americans, I'm pleased to tell you today that I've signed legislation that will outlaw Russia forever. We begin bombing in 5 minutes.
The reality is funnier than anything that we could come up with right now.
Yeah, a lot of stand-up comedians have kind of bowing out. Stuart Lee, I saw, saying he was just taking a digital step back, digital holiday, really, because comedy's not funny anymore. A lot of comics are just kind of trying to resituate like what comedy is now.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's also difficult to joke about a topic that's causing so many issues for so many people. And how do you even joke about it? It gets to a point where, you know, it's not funny to joke about Hitler.
Yeah, satire stops working. It's really hard to add comedy value.
We've got 43 likes now on the podcast as well. Oh, they actually said thank you at Cyber Show. Oh.
Kill them.
Who's that? The guys that you just said, Netlib or something?
Netlib Security, yeah. Transparatory, encrypt data on legacy system service devices and distributed applications. They're cool. Mm. We're now in the top. I mean, that was only 21 hours ago. Okay. It just means that we've got the most engagement. So that's really good.
Hey, maybe it's really nice that we just got a fresh episode out. I think it's getting a little bit closer to the authentic us that we wanted and envisaged in the first place.
Yeah.
Yeah, people are clearly enjoying it. So that's good that people are sharing it on and quoting it and saying, well, we're going to listen to like this entire fucking collection all weekend.
Oh, yeah. That's scary, isn't it? The thought of like somebody just listening to us on a binge for the weekend.
That's amazing.
They go fucking mental. They would go completely mad. We need a health warning to put on our products, really.
Shall I ask them?
Pardon Roberts, didn't he? Dread Pirate. Who, I don't know what the dude's real name is. Silk Road guy.
Ross Ulbricht. Ulbricht. You're letting me out now? Oh, all right then.
Fuck it, here's a load of drugs. Just buy them on the internet and get so fucking off your tits over the next 4 years, you have no idea what we're doing. You have no idea what we're doing.
Dread Pirate Roberts. For what political position do you think? Wouldn't he just make him like head of Big Pharma or whatever?
He even hired a hitman at one point.
All sorts of crazy shit.
I mean, it's not like he sold a bit of weed. No, it was $200 million of drugs. Six murders for hire, including one against former Silk Road employee.
No whistleblowing at Silk Road then.
I guess what Trump needs is a guy who did like what the CIA used to do in the 80s with Contra drug running and stuff like that. But now they can't do that anymore.
He's got one.
Busted. He needs a kind of hoodlum.
He's got one.
He needs a little gangster.
He's got one. Elon Musk, right?
Musk and Trump remind me of Marv and Harry from Home Alone.
So you're saying they can be defeated by the Trump? Yeah. That would be interesting, wouldn't it, politically? If just some kid becomes viral and he's just like, he's a wanker, he's a wanker. Trump, I'm quoting here, wanker. I've given TikTok back. No, that's not what's happened. And he's delayed a law that he can't prevent, essentially, which is interesting. He then says that we're going to work with the Chinese to work out a way of having it so it's not a problem to our national security. And there is that line, even by Trump himself, who freed it. that is the real truth behind why TikTok is being acquisitioned. Let's talk about the national security implications. Yeah. Right. Why is TikTok seen as a national security issue?
Well, obviously, we know that it's owned by currently a Chinese company. And that was kind of the premise of all the restrictions in the first place and why this law was impending. And the ironic thing is the conversation actually started with Donald Trump in power. He's seen as the hero for giving them a bit more time to sell to an American owner.
So obviously, Elon Musk now wants to buy it. We've been talking about this for some time, you know, why is something like that happening?
Because of the millions of users there are of TikTok, they just are very worried that all of that user data will end up in China, where it could ultimately fall into the hands of the ruling Communist Party.
You know, it's not just that it's foreign owned, because we use a lot of services interchangeably across Europe too, across the Western world. We're using a lot of each other's servers. We have European servers, US servers. We're sharing a lot of resources. So it's not the fact that it's foreign owned, it's the fact that it's Chinese owned and that data is in China. So I guess what's the difference with a server being in China and what's the difference with a server being in, say, Norway? In China, they have a very different political setup. You know, it is a communist state, so everything is owned by them. So if you are collecting data in China as a private company and it's going on your server is also owned by central government. You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
Goodness comes from within. Goodness is chosen. When a man cannot choose, he ceases to be a man.
So that data, it's not just that it's foreign owned, it's that it's going on a system owned by a central government that can be used by every other third party that they want to give it access to. So another thing is that it's outside agreement.
Exactly. And, well, it's definitely not under GDPR regulation.
No. Probably straight into a Russian server to some extent as well, because of their very close and special relationship.
It's not just the amount of data, it's also the type of data points.
Absolutely.
We've got phone numbers, email addresses, device information, video location, usage patterns, phone and social network contact lists. There's a massive chain of like friends on there.
A very powerful algorithm so far compared to a lot of the other ones. It gets to know you very, very quickly.
You're mine now.
To you as well, in a very addictive and seductive way.
I think it was the US Supreme Court actually said the data that's stored internationally, and they don't really know where the data's going. And the reason they want it to then be owned by a US company is not only is it then the owner of that data, they then have the obligation to comply, you know, actually redirecting the data in the country. And then they're obviously legally liable and they're much easier to sue.
Exactly. And you've got to think that we know for a fact that when we have an application on our phone, that they can access things like our microphone and potentially our camera as well. When it's something that's owned completely separately to that, we're not exactly sure whether those rules that they've put in or whether those settings are actually working. You think that you may have younger children, maybe 13, 14, living in the West, but their parents do really important government level jobs. Well, if that microphone's activated while they're listening or watching and engaging in that application, there is the possibility that it's picking up important and secretive information. That's the national security implication.
We have to remember app means it's software that is installed on your phone and they have control. But, you know, if you're using an operating system like Android or iOS, the actual manufacturers and the developers of these apps have the ability to just do on-the-fly code injection. And, you know, even if it's a vulnerability that they accidentally left in the software, that could lead to one-click account jacking because it's got access to the phone's operating system and so many accounts, you know, including government accounts. It doesn't matter what it is because everyone has everything on their phone.
as well as gaining a lot of data on the future generations that can be used when they move into positions of power.
I think it was our own Sirian Martin, former head of our NCSC. They actually said that the security across social media generally and other apps is so broken that TikTok is a specific example. It's just one of many wider issues with data privacy and control. Even from a government point of view, it's like, well, great, you give it to an American owner, but then what? They still have no proper jurisdiction over data control. And that's a wider issue that's kind of across the whole of Western, because social media picked up so quickly and the laws are still lagging behind about where the data is going.
But I guess since 2016, we've seen a rise of more extreme platforms coming up that do try and hide their data a bit more. And then we get a Chinese platform that comes forward as well. And so we're seeing, I guess, less and less control and less ability to monitor that data and to track that data and where it's going as we see a fragmentation of social media platforms.
So your main threat model that you're addressing is our own security services are unable to read that encrypted traffic and peer into it, as you say.
Well, just see where it's going more so than see into it. At least it's on our servers. It's over here.
The parent company of TikTok called ByteDance, this was in 2022, they actually admitted using, and this included TikTok, they used its app to actually spy on reporters. Yeah, we already know it's going on and they can see all the data.
You just have to assume
your phone is an open mic to your worst enemy all the time, basically.
I mean, what are people scared of? Who are their threats? Who are their potential enemies and so on? The trade-off was international laws are very strong and people paid a lot more attention to them than now, I think. So there were back-scratching arrangements. So we can't legally surveil our citizens. This is a state speaking. You know, we can't legally surveil our citizens. So what we'll do is we'll let you guys do it. British doing it for the Americans or the Americans doing it for the Israelis or whatever. Proxy surveillance and then selling that data. Now there's become a private market.
My other factory, I can guarantee production of 200 kilos refined every month of the year.
And it seems to be that what the Americans are trying to fix is the problem that they've sort of created, because they were the first people to do those sort of things with applications. And now suddenly someone else is doing it and they're thinking, well, actually, if we can do it, then they can do it. And that's concerning. So maybe just saying, well, I don't like it if you do it, maybe they need to actually have a look internally and say, well, everything that we're collecting could actually put our citizens at risk as well.
The elephant in the room is colossal hypocrisy. Let's take it from the point of view of the operator, the end user, for a moment. Which phone do you choose? Let's say you had a choice between an iPhone and an HTC. And the latter one, you know very well, is full of backdoors to the Chinese Communist Party. The other one is the iPhone. So you think, well, where do my sort of loyalties lie? I know that if I choose one, my own government are going to be collecting all that information because that company's done a deal with my own administration. The other choice is to allow a foreign government to see into your life.
Right.
And many people would have said in the past, well, you're kind of better off letting the Chinese know anything about it, because the government that you should fear is your own government. They're the ones who have the most power to harm you. Mm. They are the closest to you. On the other hand, if democratically elected, maybe there's some be less worried by it, you know, because hold on, haven't I kind of tacitly granted some kind of consent? Well, it turns out, no, you haven't. In both cases, it is non-consensual surveillance. It's illegal wiretapping. It's not with informed consent, etc. Right, mm-hmm. So it's extra contractual, even if it's in the private domain or whatever. So you're faced with this apparent dilemma. You know, which one do you choose? And it's very interesting. And I think for a very long time, people have thought, you know, I really don't care what the Chinese government know about me. things have really changed in terms of international law, power balances of, like I said in the last episode, people just don't care anymore. And without that strong rule of law, now it's just down to like which gangs are selling like the most data to who. Like, who are you going to get them from?
How much gear?
A lot of gear.
Collaborate. Work together in state and private surveillance. Making a market. TikTok are in there. They've got leverage as to the extent that TikTok is a popular addictive application amongst Western youth. It's an asset for the CCP. They love that. You can use it as leverage to win more data. There's a international data market out there. If you don't want that, how much do your representatives, your government, wish to stand up for your digital rights? Now, in what capacity are they protectors of your digital rights? In order to become protectors of your digital rights, they have to buy in, they have to eat the dog food, they have to say, okay, it's not okay to just have warrantless surveillance of everybody's lives and you can buy and sell that data as you please. So having established some principles, now you've got to enforce them and live up to them. And that's the trick, isn't it?
As I mentioned earlier, we had the English riots. A lot of that was fed with misinformation through social media apps. And they were able to trace those people who were sending messages that encouraged violent attacks. They can say, right, well, we're not going to spy on everyone by mass, but what we are going to do is when we're in a situation like that and we know there's crime, we're going to ask the applications to...
When it's kicking off on the street and people are firing rocks, you can see who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the police have cameras. They used to take cameras to demonstrations in the 1980s.
I mean, the real crime...
You don't need any of the sort of techno spookery shit fuckery.
Yeah, but the people who are encouraging that, right, are often not the people going down there. And they're spreading a lot of lies. They're spreading, hey, only a handful of users a lot of the time and are really aggressive. They are inciting violence. There's a huge distrust in society at the moment of governments and of media, traditional...
There is a lot of distrust of government and of media. Both of them could perform useful functions and both of them could act very easily to diffuse lots of situations and problems that we have today, but they don't. They're not motivated to, right? So you need to ask that question, why are they not motivated to?
Because it's cheaper and easier to just gather all the data, right?
Very cheap silver bullet. We're going to use data to do this. Just ploughing more money into tech and tech is going to solve everything. No, you're not. It's a note to school. Please excuse Johnny from thinking today. He has forgotten his mind.
That'd be the future. The current AI grows at the current rate as well. It would just be like, you don't know anything. You just have to go and ask the computer. But you don't know if the computer is right or wrong. And we've just lost all sense of direction. And we're happy with our numbness and our dumbness. That's quite a scary prospect that's often theorised at the moment.
Yeah, I think so. And also that kind of attitude of somebody else's problem. I mean, part of the downside of governments, and especially good governments, is that they then make people feel quite lazy. Well, the government will sort that out, won't they? Whose fault is that? Oh, it's the government's fault, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, it's not my job.
Not my job, I don't know. There's got to be some boffins that will sort that out.
Get a supercomputer on it, it'll sort it.
So basically, our leaders take their blueprints from like 1950s and 60s science fiction novels.
Yeah, literally, you know, it'll just produce the number 42 and they'll just bow down to the number with no understanding of what they were on about.
I don't think it has ever worked out as a plan in any sci-fi novel that the computer that you invented did anything good, didn't run amok and kill everyone.
So TikTok was going to be shut down. Trump's brought it back to be essentially popular. He is a big advocate of social media platforms, as we're well aware. You know, that more radicalization of the platforms that he's involved in. And then we've got Elon Musk coming in. He owns X. Part of the media campaign in Trump's presidency. We got Trump saying we're going to bring TikTok back. But then at the same time, we've got Elon, who's literally in his office, saying, well, I'm going to buy it.
Now get out of here! He said that he wants to keep TikTok available because it's healthy to have competition.
How can you have competition when you own two of the biggest platforms? I think it's an absolute tyranny. His want to control the overall narrative, and not just the one he lives in, but actually worldwide. That's why he's like, I am a troll.
It's the one thing that money couldn't buy him, and now he's got both.
And you can do that because of technology.
Yeah.
You couldn't do that until we had social media platforms. It would have been very, very difficult to buy all the newspapers, even if you were the richest man. We would have seen this before. And we have seen a little bit of it, where we had that in the UK with someone owning a lot of the newspapers. But it's stopped. It gets to a certain point, laws kick in. And we say, no, we can't have everything owned by one entity. We don't do that. But social media platforms, we are. We're having that problem. Facebook straight away went, well, we're not going to fact check anymore. Twitter already doesn't. I mean, we all know that. And now we're going to have TikTok, which really aims at that younger generation, also putting out the narrative of Elon Musk and the Trump campaign in America, in countries that don't even have anything to do with their political situation at all.
It seems like we're saying that one of the great modern scourges, one of the huge problems in the world, alongside things like climate change, wars and so on, is social media itself.
Yeah,
and specifically the ownership, centralized ownership of civic communication by a handful of American companies. And yeah, that is not all of social media, or it's not a sufficient or adequate definition of social media. Social media, for want of a better description, is general civic communications. It's emails.
Podcasts.
People do not have control of that, have not had control of that really for some time. Once did have control of that, but didn't understand the opportunity and the power that they had in their hands.
Absolutely.
And the only way out of this is to restore that situation, which I believe very much can be done.
Bill, as somebody who was generation that were the first ones to use social media, and it did certainly feel like that at first when it started, that the users were really driving things. But eventually, you know, it became a marketing platform, and it loses everything about it, and it just became so commercialized, and it wasn't about connecting with your friends, family. It was just filled with... And that's really when we get to where it becomes a commercialization. It's a product. It was meant to be communication. It's become a product.
You're our product. And we can't very well have our products turning against us, can we?
Now it's a product you can buy if you're the richest man in the world, and that product can tell everyone how to think and feel.
Like owning a TV station or whatever. Right. It's a product that you can deliver to political power.
Absolutely. And it's become one-sided as well. And we saw that we had a court case where Facebook, when they were at their height, we had a whistleblower come forward. They were putting out more for one side politically because they got paid more, because more people would click, because it meant more advertising income. And so they accidentally changed the social narrative, not understanding its social obligations and just fully going for the money. That's a real corruption at its heart.
Yeah, to solve this problem, we have to break private-state alliance. That's the kind of techno-fascism aspect to it.
When I think about social media, I think about the overall control aspect as well. It's not just the obtaining of the data and using it and for AI training or whatever, but there's also this feeling of socializing with other people on the internet. There's a deeper problem here. We've got algorithmic manipulation, for one, prioritizing things from the owners of the platform, showing that to more people.
And what makes money.
Yeah, that can amplify misinformation, echo chambers for people that actually want to put stuff out. It's influencing public opinion, obviously. With Instagram last week, they blocked anything to do with Democrats. It would actually not show up at all. And if you type Republican, it would actually show you all the stuff. So,
and that's just responding to who's paid for that.
Yeah.
Well, the question I asked today in most news stories is, well, who paid for that?
Money doesn't have to change hands for there to be political shenanigans.
And that's the big fear of TikTok, isn't it? That what could happen is that a whole generation, you know, the Gen Z and maybe below, could end up aligning more to the Communist Chinese Party because they've been exposed more to that due to their control of their algorithm. And I guess that's what we're seeing. Social media platforms are not just, they may have started off as a way of communicating with each other. They've become a marketing platform, but now we're seeing this huge political sort of takeover and purchasing. And by allowing someone who's very, very openly on one side to own more than their fair share, a large part of the market, they essentially are directing and buying public opinion.
I think if we went out and asked a load of people, why do you use this certain platform? It's, oh, my mates use it, and see any way I can talk to them.
Right.
There's like this overuse and reliance on social media driven by the addictive design we were talking about. And the amount of mental health issues that can lead to is just insane. Loads of studies coming out on it, and we already know because we've looked into that before.
And if you restrict your children, actually, what we're seeing now is because of those studies and a lot of the laws, particularly in Europe, that we are putting out there, parents are saying, actually, you're not having social media. I recognise it's a digital harm. You're not going to have a phone, potentially, until you're 16. It's what 11% of parents are now saying, absolutely no, I don't want you on it. It's a digital harm.
We'll use our anti-crime computer in the Batcave.
Robin. What I'm noticing is more and more children are reverting back to the childhood I had, where we just, like, phone each other.
Yeah.
In a massive conference call, and we all just talk. And they're healthier, so much healthier when they do that. And they talk for 4 or 5 hours, and they're laughing, and they can understand each other, and no one's falling out. And we need to go back into that.
The telephone!
The telephone?
Hello?
You can just call. You don't need social media. It's great to have somewhere to share pictures, but we do have that technology sitting in your hand. You can just send a group chat a photo.
People's knowledge of all of the delicious, amazing technology that exists, one-to-one voice communication, there's group communication, there's video conferencing, there's all these things, and they have been all subsumed or collected together into this one device that's my portal to the world, and that one ring to rule them all. There are so many completely different experiences from different forms of communication. A great tragedy that one has just taken over.
People get trapped in these environments for one reason or another, and this is what the companies want, obviously, because the more time people spend on these platforms getting trapped in its own ecosystem, which gives all those features to their users, this is the kind of trap that is absolutely perfect. It's making the companies money. They're able to monetize people's own communication that they would otherwise do on a phone or traditional method that we just talked about. And they can control what people see and when.
Now we're in a situation where we've got the richest man in the world who essentially, and get this, wants to become Lord of the Algorithms.
He was an absolute...
Johnson! Yes, sir!
Probably one of the difficult problems to solve is how do you incentivize states and governments who are representatives of their people's safety, security, to no longer be aligned in that kind of a pact, to no longer think that way. Take the money out of the communications, restore it to the commons, to the public domain, which is kind of what the project of the internet was supposed to be, the vision. Peer-to-peer network.
And the spread of knowledge, right? The spread of education. And we've already heard in this week that Wikipedia is under a huge amount of pressure.
Hopefully, over time, you know, the more we see these events like Musk and all this kind of nonsense going on at the moment, the erosion of public trust in governments will hopefully turn to why are you actually aligning with those companies? More awareness about the social media surveillance and propaganda all comes out.
How does that help? How does it help that people's trust in governments is eroded?
No, it doesn't. That's the, one of the long-term risks of governments actually supporting these companies. Because if the public lose trust in governments, who should be in their best interest, as we were just saying, they have responsibility for people's safety and security.
How do you incentivize governments to be less in bed with a bunch of gangsters?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? When you and Helen were actually talking about an alternative like public cloud for maybe just an actual region or even a country, giving...
This is not the first time I've heard this either. There is actually quite a lot of calls now for why do we not have a European or a UK social media platform? We obviously very clearly are different right now from our fellow allies. We don't have a central voice where we can compare that. We're using other people's platforms. So actually, maybe it's a point of the European Council and the UK as well to get creative and to get developing and make an amazing place that not only is somewhere we can go and have those conversations, but it's filled with all the beautiful things that Europe offers, all the art, all of the fantastic, you know, music and things like that, and artwork that comes out.
Why don't we put money, put effort, put education, put policy decisions into building European technology? It's not as if we're short of smart people,
No, not at all. And I think, you know, if we actually start aligning incentives with public good in that way, and even from a government point of view, if they got on board and started, I don't know, proposing tax breaks or funding incentives for actual public communication infrastructure that's free from corporate influence, people to build these things.
Be the most radical, fashionable social media on the planet, right? Because we are, that is Europe. We have so much creativity. It's been shut down in this country a little bit. We're still like the number one for arts and fashion around the world.
It's been overshadowed by a culture that is essentially dull.
There's so much opportunity for investment in local tech ecosystems, you know, create alternatives to, call it, foreign social media platforms, because they are.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
And it would hugely reduce economic reliance as well, because we're not just talking people with social media. Millions and millions of small businesses and large businesses in the UK are all reliant on TikTok itself. It's one of the biggest marketplaces.
We talked a lot about what was going on in America. I felt that there's been a real culture change in the last week. It all started with an alleged Nazi salute of Elon Musk. And that has just spread out. And what I noticed is it really felt like Eternal September type of the late 90s, when a lot of stuff that was sort of invisible to the mainstream, to the general public, suddenly went mainstream very, very quickly. And from a nerd's point of view, it was like, oh, suddenly the whole world is interested in my stuff now. And I felt that Elon Musk doing his salute made tech political in a very, very brutal and sudden way. Suddenly, all of the stuff that we've been doing for, like, you know, years or whatever, and thrust into the limelight. This guy runs and owns systems that you use to organize your daily life, that you communicate with people. Do you want a potential fascist in charge of that? And the answer is obviously a very scary hell no.
So many Teslas were getting vandalized. People were getting these bumper stickers for the back of their Teslas that said, we bought this before we knew Elon was a Nazi.
That's really sad for the people that own them. I mean, it's a bit of a kind of dick waving symbol, but nonetheless, I wouldn't want my car being vandalized for a political reason. I mean, many people who bought Teslas might have done so with the idea that they were kind of helping reduce emissions and they were helping the planet. So you can't judge someone for owning a Tesla. I mean, they are hideous mobile surveillance engines, and they're made by a company with very poor morals. But
SpaceX, for example, as well, has the most satellites. Amazing service. But again, people are starting to think you're not happy with the person in charge, but what else are you going to do?
More than the person in charge, you're not happy with the political structure that's behind it. Even if the proprietor of one of these big tech companies was an absolute saint and really kind of lived up to how Bill Gates imagines himself to be, perhaps, you know, this kind of crusader and philanthropist, you could still be really unhappy just structurally with the fact that a single person or company has total control over that. And from a pragmatic security point of view, that's a huge weakness. It's very irresilient. It's a single system of weakness and failure. So we want competition and we want plurality and we want interoperability just for continuity of operations and safety. If it turns out that the guy is a Russian mole, you know, a defector, or just goes crazy one day. I mean, just people go crazy sometimes, you know. There's a backup plan.
Yeah.
I sense that Europe, and from our conversation we had with the Danes and our conversation we've had with some other Europeans now, it's very clear that there is a concerted, well, maybe not coherent yet, movement to put distance between Europe and the US.
Yeah.
And not only are the days of big tech social media over, that stuff's going, right? It's really changing rapidly now. But also the whole big tech thing is ready for change. People are ready to say, you know what? I'm not going to use Microsoft. I'm not going to use Google. I'm not going to use Amazon. What are the British or French or German or European alternatives? I need to diversify my security portfolio. I need to build in hybrid diverse systems. I mean, we might still use some Microsoft stuff, but we're not going to run the entire company as an outpost of Microsoft and outsource it to some US company. That's not going to happen anymore.
Yeah, well, I think building diverse systems is an entire topic that we could go on for ages about. I think there's so many important points.
It's definitely in the to-do list.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
We started off talking about TikTok. I think we've moved the conversation on to an acknowledgement that centrally owned big tech social media is a menace to society and that it needs to be got rid of somehow.
Yeah.
Maybe it's time for a dawn of a new European tech epoch. Europe could rise out of the ashes like nothing you've ever seen before.
Yeah.
Hopefully social media is sort of the trigger when people say, you know what, we're dependent on this absolute rubbish. Why don't we just build something that works for us?
Yeah, let's get a meet on the go with some of the best coders and designers in Europe, and it would happen very, very quickly. You could have something that's absolutely fantastic. And think of the cultural differences that we have in Europe. There is nowhere in the world that has that. All these tiny little countries over a small landmass.
To actually make this successful, I think we need some sort of public accountability mechanism. If we're going to include governments in this, there should be, you know, maybe laws requiring public disclosure of agreements between like social media companies, if we still want to call them companies involved.
And maybe not governments, maybe civil services rather than government. Yeah. Civil services and organizations, not one political party. If you look at things like France recently, that could have gone really differently had that been the case. When people are putting out stuff that's insane, be shut down.
Policing people's content.
And no, not policing people's content, but you need to stop political parties being able to say, well, I want you to put out this many adverts in this area that swing voters to my way. That's what we need to stop, not what people share with one another. That's how it should be encouraged.
By the time that you've got eyes on misbehaviour by state-level actors or very large organisational actors, it's already too late. There's nothing that you can do about that preventatively or to mitigate. And we saw that with Brexit, right? Once people had figured out, you know, with the cold Cambridge Analytica thing, once the masses have caught up with the trick, it's too late, right? Because it's, the trick's been done and then you're just left with egg on your face. So
don't build a system where you can buy influence from the beginning.
Yeah. So one of the places that government can intervene and do very, very powerful things is on a technical level. It's about interoperability. And one of the most powerful levers and one of the things that nobody dares to touch, right, because it's such a powerful lever, trade, the intellectual property. If you reform intellectual property law, get rid of a lot of the protections that keep these massive big tech companies in power, you open them up to competition. They will be torn apart in months by hungry competition.
Do you know what's quite interesting, actually, is on that, I was looking into the antitrust division or the antitrust laws in the US, and actually all of those companies are pretty much operating against those rules and those regulations already. And their excuses, Google will turn around and say, well, actually, no one can build what we've got, so we are allowed to own the algorithm that does.
Yeah, it's exceptionalism. They have an arrogant exceptionalism.
But that's not true. There's loads of search engines.
copyright in particular. I mean, trademarks are far more benign, and you know, there are really big problems with software patents. They are absolutely blocking progress in the world. But with copyright, the cat's out of the bag. I mean, look what's happened with AI feasting on people's stuff. Big companies have shown themselves in absolute contempt for copyright. They don't care about that. If it's, as soon as it suits them to just scoop up everything, they'll do it, right? Once you get some reform in the IP area, competitors can come in and they can take out Google, they can take out Facebook, they can take out Amazon, because what's keeping them in place, what's maintaining their network effects, is that they buy laws to stop anyone competing with them. The bravest and most powerful thing that governments could do to stop that is to take away their protections.
You're listening to The Cyber Show on www.cybershow.uk.
I do think the future of social platforms is definitely going to be, you know, changing the way that social media operates. It's basically like a new POP3 or IMAP, but for email protocols, for those that don't know what those are, but for social media. It's a way that we can be interoperable with people's own kind of realms.
Let 1,000 of these things bloom and let them connect up and figure out what the common ground is. And that's the way that so many technologies that we've built have evolved. They evolve bottom up from people's use, and they say, well, I'd like to be able to do that. I'd like to be able to have control over that. I don't mind about this and that. And then you find a way of negotiating that.
The internet, even at its core, is interconnected networks.
Is exactly that. It's that it can build itself from the bottom up, in sort of from the inside out.
Mm.
And we've always had exposure control as well. We've always been able to say, well, actually, I don't like this. Like, we think right back to the website days. I don't like this website. I won't go on it again. Why don't we do that with social media platforms? If you start going on there and you think, do you know what? I think this thing's brainwashing me, or all this thing's spying on me, or it's just advertising, it's junk.
Nuke them. Get them before they get you.
It's the only way to be sure.
It's important that we start thinking about security a bit more seriously. Cybersecurity is still a very fairy land. No one realizes that suddenly everything is reliant on it, including water, national infrastructure, literally everything. I think anything that uses a computer is now important. I think we said before in a podcast about supply chains, and the food supply chain would grind to a halt after 2 days. But that's just one major example. It's just this. Cybersecurity professionals in the industry are dealing with some toggle boxes in a Microsoft Azure environment or any kind of Active Directory. They're usually looking at accounts within organizations. That's the extent of 92%. Roughly of the industry.
That's a very suspiciously precise value you had there. 92.73.
Yeah, no. I think off the top of my head, how many organizations are using Microsoft products solely in the UK?
I see a lot of that kind of administration with big tech tools, Microsoft tools and stuff. Mm. It's a make work exercise. And that's what Helen was saying. And another comment is, well, it's great if you need something to do at work all day long. It's like, let's just tweak the access settings. But, you know, a serious opponent just tunnels under that or comes in through a different door.
That's what I mean. To me, it's like everyone's dealing with layer 7 up here. Most security professionals are dealing with like layer 7. And to me, it's just like someone sat on a little tyke's pretending that they're driving a train and then the train is actually moving below them. It's like they're pretending that they're driving this thing, but really it's
yeah, like
not.
A kid sitting on a toy train on a real train.
Yeah, that's literally how I imagine that kind of level of control over security platforms and stuff, especially if you're using public cloud services.
In danger from toys? Why, that's the silliest thing I ever heard.
And I think we've got a similar situation in cybersecurity and have had for a while, of hubris and overconfidence that comes from big tech companies, mostly American, Microsoft, Google, whatever, who present this very partial understanding of cybersecurity. You know, we lock down this account and create these access control lists and add a bit of encryption here. And absolutely none of that talks about the deep fundamental constructs that even define what security is. And worse than that, they kind of bake in their own parochial corporate values. So the flavor of security that they're selling to you is really security that works for them, that works for the data harvesting industry. We're coming in at a conceptual, philosophical level, a political level, a psychological level, and saying to people, look, this is what security really is. It's not a bunch of checkboxes on a Microsoft application.
I'm not blaming the professionals themselves. I'm sure if they were actually put in an environment where it was beneficial to big bosses to make more cybersecurity decisions and be in charge of systems and networks and whatever else it might be able to do that.
They would be, but a lot of people don't trust the cybersecurity personnel.
No.
So there's a very interesting split within organizations where the people whose remit it is to do this stuff aren't trusted. And if you're Darth Vader, you don't want your lieutenants telling you what to do.
Mm.
And so security gets pushed into a very strange situation where you don't have the voice or the power or the capabilities to do the things you know that you need to do. So you just settle back into a comfortable role of doing the bare minimum that keeps
comfortable
you
role of giving it all to Microsoft instead.
This is not my fucking problem, man. You fucked her up. You fucking deal with it.
Yeah, absolutely. You stop. Yeah, you become a security practitioner and you stop being a security thinker.
Yeah.
It's part of a corporate creed of overconfidence that people have picked up from the political sphere, and it's got into that kind of MBA public relations mindset that you never admit defeat, you know, always try to smug it out, always put your chin out. It's very, very counterproductive in security because the one thing that you really need is the one fallible voice that says, actually, we've got a real weakness here and we're going to be stuffed if somebody exploits it. And no one will give that person the room to speak because they imagine that that is demoralizing.
Mm.
And it's not demoralizing, it's motivating. So, okay, come on, guys, we need to plug that hole now.
Especially in the age we're in now, where there's very much a kind of hybrid war situation going on, state-sponsored cyber attacks from both sides of the environment.
So let's talk some more about confidence and risk.
I see it in individuals when they talk about their own personal cybersecurity. And it becomes a kind of, oh, well, yeah, I know they've got my data, but, you know, everyone has these days and that's it. That's the end of it. And there's no like real consideration of risk in it.
Like resignation and learned helplessness.
It's kind of like when you don't know the ins and outs of like the real risk of something because you don't do it for a living and actually what can be done with data, you know, they're not just storing it for fun. There was a YouTube guy and he was talking about things like Tesco Club Card, loyalty schemes.
Show us this loyalty.
I don't care if they know how many packets of raisins I bought this year. I'll get 20% off my shopping, so that's all fine. I don't know if it's because people just don't understand the risks. It just seems to be a very chronic situation in relation to data security, understanding of how data can be exploited, especially with machine learning and analytics tools that are available, and the actual cost of people's data and what that might benefit the recipient.
I don't want to accuse anybody who has a cheerful and sunny disposition of being naive, because I'd like it that we could all be like that. But I think what's missing is kind of, there's just not enough dark side in. They don't see what can be done.
Mm.
And they don't think like saboteurs, like special operations, like criminals.
You filthy criminals.
They don't think in that mindset.
Of, no.
If I had this, what could I do with that? You know, how could I be really mean or really greedy or whatever?
Oh, naughty, naughty.
Mm.
So that mindset's missing. And it's almost like the children, that like you don't want to break their spirit. You don't want to make them grow up too young.
Mm.
But I often find myself talking to people about cybersecurity, and I'm absolutely gobsmacked by their naivety.
I think the way I would summarize it is I am always shocked by people's what I would call acceptable level of risk. It seems to be that convenience always kind of slips people up. Even massive organizations like telecoms providers. Oh my God, no wonder you got hacked. And this is the kind of standard practice? Like, what's happening to the industry here?
A lot of it's group psychology and things like that, survivorship bias, or people's sense of invulnerability comes from their institutional affiliation. By association, I work for an elite company.
The ego side of it and the influence that has on a company, it really irks me when security people have an opinion that their platform or service is completely indestructible in a way that's quite scary.
I am invincible! No magic stronger!
Especially for customers that are using it, because it doesn't influence security updates and bug fixing and code analysis and all the other important things with any software. Nothing is ever fully secure, no matter how many walls are put in front of it or whatever.
You're listening to The Cyber Show.
You're listening to the best tech podcast on the internet, The Cyber Show, on www.cybershow.uk. Since 2023, we've been bringing you the cream of inane banter and irreverent, unsubstantiated opinion based on conversations we've had down the pub, and occasionally some well-researched expert opinions on political topics way, way ahead of the media curve. We offer a humanistic take on national and civic cybersecurity, digital rights, privacy, technology choice, and digital self-defense. We love to chat with expert guests from around the computing world, from the industry, and voices from the arts, civil institutions, and media. Our work is completely independent, free from commercial and political leverage, and hosted on a tracking-free website. If you want to support The Cyber Show, please don't recommend us on Spotify, Facebook, Trustpilot, LinkedIn, Blue Sky over Mars, or Red Sky in the morning. Just tell a close friend. When human beings share things that they genuinely enjoy, that's so much more powerful than anything you say on social media, where the discourse is strictly controlled by the very forces that we hope to overcome. So tell people you know and like, your family, your neighbour, about the best tech podcast on the network, The Cyber Show.
Don't find me on Facebook. Let's keep things private. I will not update my status. In person, IRL. Give me analog, unpixelated, skin against skin. A glance, a sigh, a smell and sound beyond a prying eye. Give me room to feel a breath on my skin. Don't find me on Facebook. Do not like my posts. Or stalk my exes. There are times I want to be forgotten. No permanent record of my bad poetry, my mistakes and misjudgments. Do not cancel me. Don't find me on Facebook. Find me a private space offline, unmoderated, speakeasy. Use email if you want to speak to me. When we are apart, be secure. Private, not secret. Not to be invaded. Don't find me. not sell my data. I am not for sale, nor to be analysed. Leave me. I'm digitalised and unpixelated. Don't find me. I am not there. The Cyber Show.